about him. The stubborn streak a mile wide, the prickly attitude, the times he'd come through for me when it really mattered. I love you, Dad. I felt the vibration of a response, but his words were lost in a sudden loud snap and a horrible groaning creak as the house jerked hard to the right. I clutched at him. Here goes. Hold on.
What the hell you think I'm doing?
He snapped back, and I damned near laughed with delight at his ornery spirit. And then there was no more time for talk. With a final groan, the house slid fully off its pilings, then tilted like a capsizing yacht. My dad reflexively scrambled for purchase as we began to slide, but I kept my grip clamped around him. As we slid toward the water, I tried to kick us away from the roof, suddenly filled with the image of us getting sucked under by the sinking house. Didn't make a difference. The roiling current snatched us and threw us right into the thick of the maelstrom. Water closed over our heads, and I kicked frantically, but I couldn't even tell which way was up. Something hard and heavy smacked into us, and I briefly lost my grip on my dad. Only the pants and jacket tied around us kept me from losing him entirely. I got an arm around him again, broke the surface, coughing and sputtering. Dad, I gasped. Dad? His arms hung limp in the water, but he gave a weak cough and moan, reassuring me that he was still breathing at least. I clung to him with one arm while I fought to keep both our heads above water by kicking my feet and desperately paddling with my free arm. A gray-toned world, its sounds oddly flat, told me that my senses had faded, meaning I was either hurt or tired as all hell. Damn good chance it was both. The current flung us about, and I whimpered in barely controlled terror. Something hit me hard in the back, driving the breath from me. I faltered in my frantic treading but somehow managed to get us back to the surface after only a couple of seconds. The raging water swept us past houses, light poles, trees, and who the hell knew what else. I had absolutely no way to tell where we were or how far the flood had carried us. I made a flailing grab at a tree as we swept by and managed to get my arm hooked around a branch. A thump, thump sound penetrated my dull senses in the roar of the water. The helicopter. But how the hell would they find us? We were nowhere near where my house used to be. Though I thought I could see the chopper approaching, I didn't dare let go of my dad to wave for help. I didn't trust our makeshift safety belt to hold him, and I needed every ounce of strength to keep his head above water.
Angel, kids.
I barely heard the moan. Here, Dad, I gasped out. I hear a helicopter. Can you wave your arms or something? He floundered an arm out of the water in a weak wave.
If I die, you're not gonna die,
I yelled at him, though it came out as more of a strangled croak. Shit. My voice was going all raspy. I was gonna start falling apart soon. Without any warning, the branch I held gave way. I let out a startled shout as the current sucked us away, but only a second later something punched me in the back, and I jerked to a hard stop. Oddly, I didn't have any problem staying afloat, but when I fumbled my free hand behind me to see what I was stuck on, I realized why. I was wedged in the fork of a tree branch right below the surface, except that one side of the fork was, well, in me. Hunger flared hot and bright, telling me quite clearly that the branch had done some serious damage. Sudden worry gripped me and I dragged a hand along the front of my torso, shuddering in relief once I confirmed that the branch hadn't penetrated and hurt my dad as well. He still struggled to wave the approaching helicopter down. I tried to lift the arm that wasn't clamped around his waist, but my movements were too sluggish to be worth much. Instead, I wrapped my legs around him and fought the intense rising hunger. I still had two bottles of brains in the side pocket of my pants, but there was zero way to get them out now without risking losing them, or my grip on my dad. The helicopter swept low toward us, then over and past, while I stifled a scream of frustration. They didn't see us. My dad let his arm flop back down into the water.
Now what?
He asked, voice weak and barely audible. Blood seeped through his hair on the back of his head, and I took in the scent of the brain beneath it. Now what? I echoed, then inhaled deeply. Everything slowed down. The roaring rush of the water receded to a murmur. Peripheral vision dimmed as though all light gathered into that single mouth-watering focal point in front of me. Dad? Brains. My breath hissed as I looked for something to bash the head against. Branch. I snarled in deep satisfaction, shifted my grip to hold my meal between my hands.
Rushing water tried to pull it from me, steal it, and I held tighter, twisted toward the branch.
Angel?
The sound vibrated against my chest.
Angel, what?
Stopped me. The smell called me. That voice. I screamed in frustration. An annoying thundered overhead. Wind whipping, water thrashing. I raked my gaze upward, ready to scream my defiance, focused. Helicopter? Helicopter. I clung to the bizarre concept like a lifeline and expanded on it. Flood, Dad, hands on my dad's head, no. I released it and wrapped my arms around his waist, breath whistling through my teeth with my conscious effort to hold off biting at the base of his skull. I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. Helicopter, here. I love you just a minute. I can hold on just a minute. I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. Someone tried to take my dad, my meal, my dad, from me. I grabbed for what he cut. Pants jacket, brain bottles, mine. Wrapped it around my numb fist. Mine. I clawed at the man as he ripped my dad away, rose impossibly in the air. I screamed, reached for him. Nothing. Nothing. I sank back, breath gurgling, going still, going quiet, conserving, waiting, an irresistible scent filling my senses, getting closer. Brains. I squinted against the wind as my prey descended toward me, my lips pulled back from my teeth in an eager snarl. I scrabbled against the tree branch, struggled to lunge and attack, rend and feast. He leaned toward me, and I threw my arm up, grabbed his ankle, pulled, snapped at him. He reached, clamped my jaw in his hand, forced something between my teeth. My cry of rage died away as the leathery lump registered. Brains. Chewy hunk of brains. Yes, yes, yes. My hand went to my mouth, held the chunk in place, gnawed. Brains. Better. Yes. Oh, God. Yes, I'm me. I'm me. By the time I chewed and chewed and swallowed the brain lump down, a hint of coherent thought returned to let me know I was almost up the cable with my rescuer. The desperate urge to rip his brain from his skull had eased to, gee, he sure smells yummy. But, oh my God, Dad? Nausea and worry swept through me. Dad. As soon as I neared the open side door of the helicopter, strong hands grabbed me and hauled me the rest of the way in. Someone else wrapped a blanket around me and shoved an already opened packet of brains into my free hand. I greedily sucked it down, and as soon as I finished that one, the empty packet was yanked from my grasp and replaced with a fresh one. My gut did a strange lurch, and I realized that my innards were still in the process of healing from the serious damage caused by the tree branch. After finishing the second packet, I regained the ability to actually pay attention to something besides my own hunger. My left hand was locked in a death grip around my pants with its two bottles of brains. Good old parasite survival instinct must have kicked in to grab them when the rescuer cut the jacket sleeve to free my dad. I unclenched my fingers and finally took a look around. I didn't know crap about helicopters, but this one looked military. Utilitarian gray, with two seats for crew members up near the cabin. I was buckled into one of the four fold-down seats at the back, though I didn't remember any of that happening. My dad was in the seat right beside me. He had a blanket around him and held a towel to the back of his head. He met my eyes, gave me a tremulous smile. I did my best to return it. I didn't know how much of my out-of-controlness he'd seen, but I sure as hell hoped not much. Thankfully, he'd been kind of out of it for the worst of the monster mode. For that matter, so had I. But I had been the monster for a while. If the helicopter hadn't returned, would I have been able to control myself? Would I have killed and eaten my own father? A shiver racked me. I knew the truth, and it was a punch in the gut. I almost ate my dad. The memory went through me like a knife. The scent, the drive to do whatever I had to do to get those brains, my dad's brains. No way I could have kept on living if I'd given in to the hunger and killed him. Or was suicide even an option? I had a feeling the survival responses of the parasite wouldn't make it easy. But I didn't hurt him, I reminded myself. Yeah, the helicopter had returned in the nick of time, but I'd managed to hold on for those precious few minutes, even with a goddamn tree stuck through my back. Props to stubborn bitch willpower for saving the day. I hugged the blanket around myself and accepted a third packet from the rescuer. Might as well eat their supply of brains instead of going into the two bottles in my pants, especially since I had no idea how long I'd need those bottles to last.
Whoever these people were, they sure as hell knew how to deal with hungry zombies, right down to having chewy brain cakes on hand to keep the hunger distracted. Shifting, I moved to sit closer to my dad. The thwopping roar of the chopper made it impossible to have a conversation, but I mouthed, "You okay?" And he nodded in response. He pulled the towel away from his head, looked at the blood staining it. Scowling, I turned his head so I could look at the wound. I saw his lips move, and I had no doubt he was cussing me, but he didn't resist. To my relief, it didn't look too bad.
Probably wouldn't need stitches, but I still intended to get someone with actual medical training to look at it once we got wherever we were going. I released his head, gave him a quick hug, then made a comical effort to get my wet pants back on. I gave up after a minute of contortions and simply tied the legs around my waist, wrapped the blanket around me best I could, and sighed. Looked like I was getting rescued in my undies after all. Thank God I wasn't in the habit of wearing a thong to bed. My dad and I huddled close together for warmth and comfort as the helicopter circled the area. Two more times it descended to pluck people from the still raging waters, the neighbors from across the street who'd called the cops on us more than once for domestic disputes. A single mom who lived nearby, and her 14-year-old son, who I suspected was responsible for the disappearance of tools from our shed. Petty neighborhood squabbles were forgotten as we helped each other get settled and offered comfort as we could. Finally, the pilot seemed to feel that either there were no others needing rescue, or there wasn't enough room for more. The doors closed, and I felt us gain altitude. I wrapped an arm around my dad, shut my eyes, and tried not to think of this as the end of our world. I opened my eyes when we touched down with little more than a light jostling. Whoever the pilot was, he was damn good.
The engines wound down, and the silence when they stopped seemed unnatural after the din of before.
When the doors opened, our rescuers efficiently offloaded us and passed us into the care of waiting emergency workers and Red Cross personnel. It took a few minutes for my surroundings to sink in, and then I registered that we were in a parking lot at Tucker Point High School. About 20 yards from the helicopter, several Red Cross vehicles clustered, one marked Disaster Relief. Tucker Point High was always used as a shelter during hurricanes, so it made sense for it to be used for this as well. A vague and misplaced worry wound through me about how the movie people would do their filming with flood victims sheltering here and getting in their way. But then I decided that the school was no doubt more than big enough to accommodate everyone, and I surely had more important things to worry about. But I didn't want to worry about the more important things. Not yet. I kept the blanket wrapped around my waist and an arm around my dad, demanded that someone check out his head and snarled that I was fine. No one seemed to take any offense, and I dimly realized that I probably had an eyes wide in shock look about me. After asking a few pointed questions, I managed to learn that, earlier in the morning, engineers attempted to partially open the spillway in order to carefully bleed off the overflowing Krieger River down Coal Bayou and, eventually, out into the swamp. That would have been fine and dandy, and would have caused a few extra feet of water at the most, except that minutes after the first bay opened, the entire aged structure gave way. In one gigantic rush, pretty much all the excess water in the Krieger River diverted down Coal Bayou. The Army Corps of Engineers was already at work, though the general consensus seemed to be that at this point, there wasn't much to do except wait for the river to drop below flood stage. I hovered near my dad as a medic checked his head, and I listened to a relief worker comment in hushed tones about how the flooding had wiped out a small trailer park. I knew the place, a collection of 6 or 7 trailers with almost exclusively elderly residents. I figured there had to be other casualties as well, but no one had any hard numbers. The only possible bright side was that the worst of the flooding had been on our side of the road since the bayou ran behind our property, which meant that, apart from the unfortunately placed trailer park, probably less than a dozen houses had been affected. Moreover, at least half of those were fishing camps that weren't usually occupied during the week. "You don't need stitches," the medic told my dad, and I yanked my attention back to him. "You probably have a mild concussion, though," he added.
"I ain't going to no fucking hospital," my dad snarled before the medic could even get the suggestion out.
The young man flicked his eyes up to me. I gave him a very slight shrug and shake of my head to let him know that arguing would get him nowhere.
"All right," he said to my dad. "Be sure to get as much rest as possible. And if you have any dizziness, headache, or blurred vision, let one of the volunteers know as soon as possible."
Dad grumbled something that sounded like an okay. And with that, the medic moved on to treat the tool-stealing teen, who looked like a scared rabbit as he cradled his left arm to his chest. The sun broke through thinning clouds for the first time in a week, as another volunteer took us gently in hand and guided us toward the gym entrance. Looked like it was going to be a damn beautiful day for the end of the world. Chapter 18. It didn't seem right that it could only be 10 a.m. Everything we owned was gone. Nothing left but the clothes on our backs, and in my case, hardly that. My jacket had been shredded, and my shirt had a tree branch-sized hole in the back. Fortunately, I still had my cargo pants with its 2 precious bottles of brain smoothie. Surely it should take longer than a couple of hours to wipe out a lifetime of possessions and memories, right? What the hell are we supposed to do now? I wanted to fall apart and allow the magnitude of our loss to sink in, wallow and roll around in the grief and anger and unfairness of it. But I didn't. I had my dad to think of. I had to call work and start figuring out what steps to take, figure out a place to live until we could rebuild, or whatever the hell we were going to do. Maybe that's what maturity was all about, I mused in a weird numb fog as I pawed through hastily donated clothing for something to wear instead of a blanket. Maybe being mature wasn't just holding down a job and starting a family and buying a house and paying taxes. Maybe it was about putting a hold on your own reactions and needs until after you took care of the people who trusted you. Maturity sucked. I found clothing for me and my dad, went into the bathroom to change, then came back out and put a pile of folded sweats on the end of his cot. "Dad, here's some dry clothes. You need to get out of those wet things."
"Sure thing, Angel," he replied, voice low and subdued.
He didn't move for several seconds, while the worry that he was broken clenched tight in my chest, but then he finally stood, gathered up the clothing, and shuffled to the bathroom. A few minutes later he came back, wearing the slightly too large sweats and looking even more haggard and vulnerable because of it. In silence, he sank to the cot and laid down, back to me. Troubled, I left him there and went in search of a phone I could borrow, since the flimsy Walmart bag hadn't been enough to keep my own phone dry. I soon found a volunteer willing to let me use up her minutes. Since I was actually scheduled to be at work, my first call was to Darrell. It went to voicemail, which told me he was probably up to his eyeballs dealing with the people who hadn't been as lucky as my dad and me. "Hey, Darrell," I said after the beep. I'm not at work because I was clinging to my dad while impaled on a tree when I was supposed to clock in. My dad and I are only alive because I'm not quite human anymore. "We got flooded. Bad. Lost my phone. Everything we owned was gone. I'm at the shelter at the high school, me and my dad." I didn't know what else to say. Didn't know how to put the magnitude of "what the hell do I do now" into a voicemail. After a few seconds of my silence, the phone beeped again, and I disconnected. At least I hadn't had the coroner's office van parked at my house. Alan would have done his best to figure out a way to blame me for the collapse of the spillway so he could legitimately fire me for losing the van. I called Marcus. The ache of wanting him almost painful. So what if he tended to be overprotective? Right now that seemed pretty minor. But his cell phone, too, went to voicemail, and I left pretty much the same message for him as I had for Darrell. After I returned the borrowed phone to its owner, I got a couple of slices of pizza that had been donated by a local restaurant and made my way back to where the cots were set up. Dad had shifted to lie on his back and stare at the metal beams and fluorescent lights of the gym ceiling. "Hey, Dad, I got some pizza for us." I sank to the cot beside his, set the two paper plates down. "You want something to drink? They have Cokes and stuff."
"Not hungry," he muttered. "You eat mine."
"You gotta eat," I said, worry pulling my mouth into a scowl. He glanced over at me.
"Yeah, later."
He muttered something I couldn't catch, then sighed. I wasn't all that hungry either at the moment. "Maybe we can put a trailer on our lot," I suggested. "That wouldn't be so bad, right?" Emotions flickered across his face.
"Sure, a trailer."
It all hit me then. I mean, really hit me. The house I'd grown up in, lived my entire life in, was gone. Every picture, every scrapbook, every school paper from when I'd actually cared about school, gone. I turned away, struggling to hold it together. Now wasn't the time to break down. I couldn't do that until I'd solved our problems and figured out how to care for my dad. I sure as hell didn't need to fall apart here and let my dad think he'd somehow let me down. That would be me letting him down. Didn't matter. The tears came, and I grabbed for the blanket, pressed a corner of it to my eyes in a stupid and doomed effort to hide the fact that I was crying. Damn it. We'd already been barely scraping by, and the only reason we were even doing that well was because the house was old and paid for, which meant we didn't have a mortgage or rent to deal with. Oh, yeah. And because we hadn't shelled out for flood insurance, since we'd never flooded, so why the hell would we need anything like that? And what bank in hell would lend me money to buy a new trailer, and clothes, and furniture, and a car? Fuck. "Angel." I turned to see my dad looking around frantically. "Where's the jacket I had on?" He stood and began to dig through the blankets on the cot. "Where's my goddamn jacket?" Sniffling, I gestured toward the foot of his cot. "In the trash bag on the floor there, needs to be washed." He grabbed the bag and yanked it open. I watched him, frowning. "What's so important about your damn jacket?" I asked. He muttered something about goddamn water as he pulled the sodden jacket out and fumbled through the pockets, anxiety visibly increasing. "Dad, what's wrong?" He abruptly pulled a soggy sock, stuffed with something out of an inner pocket, and heaved a thick sigh of relief. "Here, Angelkins," he said, voice shaking as he held it out to me. "You hold on to this." Baffled, I took it from him and peered at the contents. Inside was a thick roll of bills. I jerked my gaze back up to him. "Oh my God, Dad, where did you get this? How much is in here?" His shoulders twitched up in a shrug.
"Not all that much now with everything gone, I guess. About 1,200. You should hold on to it."
Holy shit. I carefully rolled it back up. "Where'd you get it?" I repeated. I'd never in a million years suspect my dad of doing anything illegal to get that money, but damn, $1,200 was a solid chunk of cash for us.
"I've been doing a little work in the last couple of months," he said, looking down at his hands, almost as if he was embarrassed to be telling me. "Carl Castor's been letting me clean up the bar after closing and paying me cash under the table. I was saving it to buy new furniture. Maybe a new stove that I'm not always worrying is gonna burn the house down."
Pain slashed across his face, then he let out a dry chuckle.
"Can't burn the house down now, huh?"
"I think we're pretty safe from that," I said with a strained laugh. "That's why you've been out so late."
"Yeah," he said, then shrugged. "Mostly."
So he hasn't been going out drinking every night. The mostly part clued me in that he was still drinking some,
but it sure as hell wasn't as much as before if he could actually hold a job. The relief that rushed through me allowed a few pesky tears to sneak out, and I pretended to rub my eyes to wipe them away. Didn't matter that he wasn't staying totally dry. Not right now. I shifted to sit on his cot and put my arms around him. He leaned into me and let out a low sigh.
"I wanted to make it better," he murmured.
"It'll be better," I assured him, forcing myself to believe it too. "We'll figure something out. I mean, it's corny, but we still got each other." He pulled me into a hug, then straightened and peered at me.
"Now, tell me about this medical condition that don't look like any kind of condition I ever heard of."
"Oh, man." I blew out my breath, then looked around to make absolutely sure no one was even remotely close enough to overhear. I'd known that someday I'd have to tell him, but, well, I'd sort of hoped that it would be 50 years from now or something. "Last year, right before I got the job at the morgue, I, overdosed and nearly died." He stiffened.
"You never told me." "How come you never told me?"
"Well, because I shifted uncomfortably. "Things were real bad between us then. And also because, well, I kinda did die. Kinda." His eyes widened in alarm.
"What the hell does that mean? How can you kinda die?"
Shit. This was just as hard as I thought it would be. "Randy and me, we got into a fight. Randy, my piece-of-shit ex-boyfriend. I got drunk and took some pills and was sort of flirting with another guy." I winced. "Turned out he put something in my drink. A date rape drug. Took me for a drive. But I was already so high I started having trouble breathing. The guy panicked and was going to dump me out in the swamp, but he took a curve too fast and wrecked the car real bad." I trailed off.
"God, Angel,"
he breathed, guilt and pain carved into his face. "Things have been horrible between us back then. The bickering we did these days was nothing compared to the ugly and sometimes violent fights of before." "I woke up in the ER," I continued after a moment. "Naked and not a scratch on me, even though I remembered being hurt bad. I shook my head in an attempt to dispel those nightmarish memories. And there was a bag of clothing and a six-pack of, well, drinks like I have now, and an anonymous note saying I had to take a job at the morgue or I'd go back to jail." His eyebrows drew together in a frown.
"That's like something out of a movie. What's in those drinks?"
My gut clenched. Of course he'd want to know. What nutritional supplement could give me super healing ability and mega strength? Throat tight, I shook my head.
"I don't want to tell you. You'll never look at me the same." "You're my angelkins," he said, voice suddenly firm, and I nearly melted at the nickname. "When you were in the attic, you said that no matter what, you're still my angelkins. That's all that matters."
A shiver went through me, and when I spoke, it was in a voice barely above a whisper. "Dad, I work in the morgue so that I can eat..." I couldn't say it. I got made into something that night, and it saved my life. I gulped, blurted it out. "I'm a zombie."
"A what?"
He shook his head. My fingers dug into the canvas of the cot, and I stared down at the floor. "If I don't eat brains," I nearly choked on the word, "I start to rot and fall apart and get real hungry for more brains." He stood, backed a step away, mouth working in what sure as hell looked like revulsion. I shouldn't have told him, I realized with sick dismay. Telling him had been a horrible mistake. I should have lied, come up with some other explanation, any other explanation. He rubbed a hand over his face, expression a painful mix of shock, disgust, and strangely, belief. He'd seen it, after all. Seen me heal up before his eyes.
"All this time," he finally asked, voice hoarse. "Almost a year?"
Throat tight, I nodded. He fell silent again, eyes on the floor. The sick despair coiled into a thick lump in my gut, but I fought back the urge to start crying again. His gaze came back to me, and there was a hint of desperation in his voice when he spoke.
You don't have to kill people, do you?
Shaking my head, I could only be grateful he'd phrased the question the way he had. Have to? No. Not to eat, at least. The unwelcome memory of a baseball bat crushing a skull rose, and I shoved it away. No. That's why I work in the morgue, I told him. I get what I need from there, from people who've already died. Stark relief showed on his face.
Okay,
he said, exhaling, tension visibly leaving his body.
Okay, that's good. We've had ups and downs, he paused. A lot of ups and downs. And right now, you and me, we're owning up.
He hesitated, and his eyes sought mine.
Aren't we?
I took an unsteady breath.
You're okay with a zombie daughter? Don't have much choice about it, right?
His head dipped in a nod.
You're my angel. So yeah, guess I'm okay with it.
I managed a wan smile. It really did save my life. I would have died in the car wreck for sure, even if the overdose didn't kill me. He sighed and came back to sit beside me again, put an arm around me and pulled me close.
Then however it happened, I'm glad, 'cause you're here now, and I didn't have to bury my baby.
His voice broke on that last part, and I had to wipe a few tears of my own away.
But you're not dead, he said. So why'd you call yourself a zombie?
Frowning, I considered the question, then shrugged.
What the hell else would you call someone who has to eat brains?
Huh, he said, mouth pursing. Okay, you've got me there. I leaned my head on his shoulder.
There's, one more thing you should probably know, I said after a moment.
The little matter of who turned me.
You mean the one who made you into a zombie?
I shifted uncomfortably.
Yeah. You don't want to tell me?
I screwed my face into a grimace. You won't like it, I told him. But he saved my life, Dad. He stiffened.
Not that no-account drug-dealing Clive.
That asshole? I gave a snort of humorless laughter.
Oh, hell no.
The last time I'd seen my former pill provider was when the cops hauled him away for disturbing the peace and possession of drugs with intent to distribute. Truly a beautiful sight to behold. No. It was Marcus.
The cop,
he said too loudly. My shoulders hunched.
Yeah. Him.
His mouth formed a dark scowl.
Well, shit, Angel. How am I supposed to hate him if he saved your life?
I burst out laughing. Oh, my God. I guess you're fucked, Dad. He gave a dry chuckle.
Story of my life, Angelkins.
Well, you're stuck with me now. He hugged me, kissed the top of my head.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
Chapter 19. The Tucker Point High School gym was one creepy-as-hell place at night. I lay on my cot, wide awake, soaking in the ambiance. Light from the sodium lamps outside streaked in through the high windows, casting alternating patches of shadow and weak amber. Pipes near the locker rooms groaned periodically, and more than a couple of roaches the size of my hand, well, almost, had skittered across the floor in the last half hour. Didn't seem to bother my dad. He lay on his back, snoring softly. A dozen or so other refugees slept, or did a good imitation of it, on cots grouped in family clusters around the gym. In the far corner, a few played a subdued game of cards, faces stricken and empty. A mix of men, women, and children, all homeless, all without anyone to take them in. Like my dad. Like me.
Like me.
I didn't want to think about it, but there it was, staring me right in the face. Not only hadn't Marcus come to find me, he hadn't sent a message or anything. Sure, he was probably busy all day with the sheriff's office taking care of the shit end of flood stuff. But now it was after 9 p.m. and nothing. I sighed. Who was I kidding? It was pretty obvious he decided, fuck you, Angel, was his response to my hanging up on him. I sat up on the stupid cot and pulled on the donated sneakers, after shaking them to be sure that none of the members of Roach Explorer Troop 666 had made their way inside. Standing, I stretched out the kinks in my back left by the non-existent cot padding, pulled the thin blanket a bit higher over my dad's shoulders, then crept out of the room. The elderly security guard in the hallway looked up from his book and gave me a gently inquisitive look.
Everything okay?
With the white beard, jovial expression, and slight bulge in the middle, if this guy didn't already make extra money playing Santa every year, he sure as hell could. Yeah, just can't sleep, I told him, shrugging. Figured I'd get some air. He gave an understanding nod.
At least the rain stopped, he said. It's a nice night for a walk, but be careful, okay?
Yes, sir, I said. I'll be good.
Wouldn't want to get on the naughty list.
He smiled warmly, returned his attention to the book. I slipped out the door. The air was a touch cooler than I expected, but not enough to go back inside to scrounge for a warmer shirt or jacket. I hugged my arms around myself and took a deep breath, looked up at the star-filled sky. Now what? I silently asked. The problem was that it was too easy to focus on everything that was gone. There was so much of it. A giant cloud of loss. House, cars, clothing, furniture. Marcus. I knew I needed to take stock of what I still had and resist the overwhelming desire to slip into depression and self-pity. But damn, this was surely one of those situations where a little self-pity was allowed, right? The sidewalk led to a practice field on the back side of the gym, not particularly scenic, but with fresh air and without skittering roaches or generalized creepiness. Off to my right loomed the dark football stadium where, only a few days ago, Marcus and I had spent a very enjoyable hour. Seemed like a dream now, with a hazy, couldn't-possibly-be-real quality about it. I sat on a concrete bench in the shadow of the building and leaned back against the bricks. The darkness felt safe, a hidden vantage to watch over the minimally lit school grounds. Safe. What the hell did that mean anymore? After the attack and the flood, I didn't know if there really was such a thing. I forced myself to consider the positives. The biggest was that my dad and I were alive and okay, of course. And I still have a job. That's pretty damn good. At least I sure as hell hoped I did. I had a hard time believing I'd get fired for not showing up to work on the day my house got washed away. Even Alan wasn't that much of a dick. Not that I wanted to place any bets on that. I also had every reason to believe that the freezer full of my stash of brains was safe and sound in my storage unit. That was on the other side of town, so it wouldn't have been affected by the spillway. Okay, so I currently had as assets life, dad, job, and brains. Oh, and 1,200 soggy dollars. Yesterday, Marcus would have been on the list. Damn it. Taking a deep breath, I pushed away the pain that tried to rise again. A rasp of sound to my left cut my musing short. I froze, listening, labored breathing. Grateful that the bench was in shadow, and that by blind luck I'd chosen dark clothing, I willed myself to remain still. I knew that sound, one that could only come from lung tissue breaking down, accompanied by a hint of fluid. This was a zombie, and likely a very hungry one. My pulse gave a weird double thump as the figure came around the corner of the gym and limped away from me along the perimeter fence of the practice field. Not just any zombie. This was Philip.
The asshole was obviously suffering and hungry.
Smug satisfaction with maybe a touch of gloating washed through me, but a moment later yielded to a rush of dismay as Philip stumbled and nearly fell. Reflexively, I threw out my hand as though I could reach him and offer support. Damn. There it was again. Whatever parental instinct my parasite had included in its total package. However, this time I was aware of it. If I hadn't felt the out-of-place compassion for Philip during the extreme bullshit at the boat launch, I probably wouldn't have given it a second thought and chalked it up to natural compassion. Both perspectives were alive and kicking and a genuine part of me. I hated Philip and he terrified me, but it also twisted my guts to see him hurting. Was this why Marcus was so overprotective? Because he was my zombie daddy? And if so, did he even realize it was his parasite influencing him? Now there was some serious food for thought. Not that it mattered anymore. But for now, I wanted, no, needed, to see what the hell was going on with Philip. As silently as possible, I stood and followed at enough of a distance that he wouldn't be able to hear me. I was fairly sure there was no risk of him scenting me. As hungry as he was, he'd be keyed to brains that were actually edible and wouldn't be able to detect much of anything over his own decay. He continued along the fence line, then slipped between two outbuildings to cut across a lot and onto a dark residential street. I hung back before crossing the empty lot, certain that he'd glance back at any moment and bust me, but he seemed utterly focused on his destination, and I managed to follow without incident. I almost missed it when he ducked off the sidewalk. He headed into the shaggy yard of a vacant Acadian single-story house that outdid the creepiness of the gym by about 1,000%. I drew back into the shadow of a tree and watched as he pulled a paper bag out of his jacket, went to the side of the steps, crouched, and... what the hell was he doing? His back to me, I could only wait and wonder what the fuck was going on. I heard a couple of soft clicks, a disturbing muffled noise, like a sob or moan, then the quiet rustling of the paper bag. After about a minute, he stood, hands clenching and unclenching as his gaze swept the area, face twisted in desperation. He didn't have the bag in his hands anymore. Had he tucked it back into his jacket? Left it under the steps? I remained still, watching him barely daring to breathe. He stood, returned to the sidewalk, and crossed back toward the lot, his breathing even more labored and noisy. On the other side of the street, he paused, visibly shaking, head jerking to the side the way it had when he attacked me at the boat launch. I watched as he appeared to grapple with indecision. Then he turned to the right and continued, near staggering up the street. After a brief internal debate, I hurried to the steps, crouched and peered under. Yeah, that did a lot of good. Since I didn't have a flashlight, my only option was to reach under and feel. Okay, I was a tough-ass zombie, but something about reaching blind under those haunted house steps made me question how badly I really wanted to know what was under there. After a brief struggle with my inner wimp, I put my hand into that darker darkness and groped for who the hell knew what. My fingers brushed something hard and movable, and a second later, I pulled out a shoebox-sized black plastic container with a snap lid. Moving quickly, I flipped the catches and lifted it into the dim light to peer at the contents. Two zip-top baggies, one with a USB flash drive, and the other with a bunch of 2-inch square papers, each with a number penciled in one corner and a dark splodge in the center that looked suspiciously like... blood? What the hell was going on? I snapped the box closed and shoved it back under the steps, then hurried to the street to see if I could locate Philip. He'd been moving slowly, probably to conserve his resources, and to my relief I caught a glimpse of him as he turned a corner about a block up the street. I broke into a jog to catch up and saw him ahead. I followed him a few more blocks to the parking lot of a small brick warehouse-like building that had seen better days, deserted except for two cars near me on the edge of the lot. Philip's attention seemed to be completely focused on reaching the building, so I took the opportunity to duck behind one of the cars to watch him. He stopped about a dozen feet from the first of two doors, a dismal solid thing with faded paint and a flush lock. He dropped into a crouch, wheezing so badly that I half stood to go to him. I clamped down hard on that mama zombie impulse and huddled down again, heart pounding from nearly revealing myself. I took a shaky breath and tried to figure out what he was doing. I had the feeling he was psyching himself up to go to that door, but why hesitate? He was big and bad and tough, even without being a zombie. After about a minute, he stood and staggered to the door, one hand on the wall for balance. The light above the door illuminated his face, and I had to bite back a noise of dismay. He looked awful. Yeah, he had some mild zombie rot happening, but that wasn't what got to me. His eyes and features radiated a level of pain and despair that struck right to my core, even beyond any parasite-driven compassion. Before Philip could knock or ring a bell or anything, the door opened, and a Hispanic-featured man in a dark blue suit stepped out, a raised gun in his hand, his eyes narrowed as he took in Philip's appearance.
"Sir," I heard Philip rasp, "I need sustenance and stabilizer. There was none at the drop."
The suited man frowned.
"Wait right there," he told Philip. "Don't move."
He lowered his gun and pulled a phone off his belt, dialed a number.
"Glenn,"
he said a few seconds later.
"Reinhardt is on our doorstep."
A pause as his gaze swept the parking lot. I shrank back in the shadow of the car.
"No, no sign of anyone else."
Philip remained still as ordered, and then the sound of a female voice came from the open doorway. Though I couldn't see her, I knew that voice. Why couldn't I place it?
"Well, do you have them?"
The suited man looked back at the speaker and shook his head.
"Not yet. Reinhardt's here. He says he needs brains on stabilizer."
What the hell was stabilizer? Did that have something to do with how messed up Philip seemed to be? The woman stepped to the door, and I sucked in a breath as shock coursed through me. Slim and auburn-haired, and probably only a couple of inches taller than me. Of course the voice was familiar. Dr. Christy fucking Cherish. I hadn't recognized it immediately, since this time she wasn't using an intercom on the other side of a lab observation window while she forced me to do horrible things. Last time I saw her, she was fleeing the about-to-blow-up factory with Philip and a handful of other guards. I'd figured she'd gone and set up shop somewhere else, since she wasn't the sort to let one failure stop her. Ever since Philip tackled me on the movie set, I'd had the nagging worry that she was around. She had on simple jeans and a sleeveless blue top, and didn't look much like a cold-as-ice crazy scientist, but I knew better than to let her lack of a lab coat this time fool me. The bitch had no heart. The man at the door lifted his gun slightly, and Cherish stepped back out of sight.
"Dr. Cherish,"
Philip said, the ugly rasp in his voice even harsher than before.
"Please, ma'am, I need brains and stabilizer."
Even though I couldn't see her, I definitely heard the condescending sneer in her voice when she spoke.
"You were left more than enough a couple of nights ago," she snapped. "If you failed to ration them appropriately, it's not up to us to waste more resources on you. Get them from your handlers. Now leave before you're spotted."
"Required extra,"
Philip wheezed, desperation tinging his rough voice.
"God, please, ma'am, please. I can't do this."
My hands curled into fists. Even as much as I hated Philip, I dearly wanted to slug Cherish for being such an all-around heartless bitch. I already owed her quite a few hard punches. I knew what it was like to starve as a zombie, but this was something different, worse. Pieces started to fall into place. Philip, Tim Bell, Roland Westfield, all three had been with her when she had me kidnapped. If she hadn't been fully working for Saberton then, it sure as hell looked like she'd signed on since. The bitch in question gave an aggravated huff.
"This one time only, and then you leave and don't come back here."
A moment later, she returned to the door and handed a paper bag to the suited man, who in turn gave it to Philip.
"Now go," Cherish ordered.
Philip clutched the bag to his chest and backed away.
"Thank you, ma'am,"
he rasped.
"Thank you,"
he repeated, then turned and staggered off. Cherish turned to suit man, mouth tight and eyes narrowed.
"Get the items from the drop now," she ordered. before both returned inside and the door closed.
What the fuck?
Could this be the place where Heather rescued the zombie Garrett from his vivisection hell? It was only a few blocks from the movie set where she'd followed Brent Stewart to kill him, so it was more than possible. After all, how many secret labs could one town hold? But any fantasies I might have had about breaking in and freeing zombie prisoners were gone now that I'd seen it would be pretty much impossible without getting shot a whole bunch. Or tranked, which would be even worse, since it would probably land me right on my own vivisection table. Suppressing a shudder of horror, I waited another minute or so in case the door opened again, then crept along the back of the parking lot and in the direction Philip went. I reached the street and froze as I saw him crouched not 10 feet away, his focus on the paper bag as he tore into it. Heart pounding, I eased back into the bushes beside the warehouse sign and watched. Philip ripped open a packet, much like the ones that Brian and Rachel had given me, and downed it, near weeping in relief.
Must be standard zombie issue in the corporate world, I thought with a soft snort.
He downed a second packet, and then went still as though waiting for the brains to take effect. Behind me, I heard the warehouse door swing open, and I cast a cautious glance that way. The suited man stepped out, waited for the door to close fully behind him, then headed for the car I'd hidden behind earlier. I remained motionless as he cranked it and pulled out of the parking lot, then let out a soft breath of relief as he passed without looking my way. For the millionth time I wondered what the hell was going on. Cherish had told him to go get the stuff from the drop spot. I grimaced. I probably should have pocketed the USB drive when I had the chance. Did the contents of that black box have anything to do with the attack on me? God, it felt like a century ago now, though I knew it had only been a couple of days. And what if they came after me again? Or my dad? Worry clutched at my gut. I needed to get back to my dad. I turned and slowly worked my way behind the bushes, intending to emerge on the street a block or so down.
Angel,
Philip said from behind me, voice ragged. I sucked in a breath and spun to face him, my heart slamming as if it was about to burst out of my chest. He stood on the sidewalk, no more than a few strides away, tatters of the bag in one hand and the empty packets in the other. His eyes met mine, intense and wild, his expression shifting with emotions I didn't have the time or inclination to identify. I tore my gaze away and broke into a run, sneakers slapping the pavement. Half a block away, I glanced back to see if he pursued, but he remained where he was, watching me go. I controlled the urge to run the rest of the way back to the school, since doing so would be stupid. I only had 2 bottles of brains left, and as long as I didn't do something clever, like go for a midnight jog, they would hopefully last me until I could get to my stash. I compromised and walked at a quick pace, continuing to cast glances back over my shoulder to see if Philip or anyone else followed. Thankfully, the streets remained empty, and I made it back without incident. The security guard stood waiting by the door when I returned. He smiled and gave a sigh of obvious relief.
"Thought something had happened to you," he said as he held the door for me.
I thought of telling him that I could take care of myself, but I'd taken care of myself for a long time. Instead, I simply gave him a nod and a smile. "Thanks for worrying." I headed down the hall to the gym, oddly comforted by the fact that someone I barely knew gave a shit. Chapter 20. Hungry. I detoured to the small fridge in the coach's office where I'd stashed my bottles. Both were still there to my relief, probably because I'd marked them in big black marker, "Prescription! Do not drink!" After a brief internal debate, I went ahead and got one out and chugged it down. With the ongoing zombie weirdness, I figured it'd be best if I wasn't hungry. My dad was still snoring on his cot when I returned to the gym. I climbed onto mine and managed a couple hours of horrible sleep before the sirens from a passing ambulance jerked me awake.
One of the great things about living in the country was the quiet.
Of course, the drawback was that I hadn't learned to tune out the sounds of city traffic, even a city as small as Tucker Point. Though exhausted, my mind whirled with worry. Getting back to sleep proved impossible, and I eventually gave up trying and stared at the damn ceiling until my bladder insisted I make my way to the bathroom. I did my business and was almost back to my cot when I spotted a figure standing by the wall on the other side of my dad's cot. At first, I thought it was one of the other refugees. Then his head jerked. I sucked in a sharp breath. Goddamn Philip again. "You get the hell away from my dad," I told him, my voice low and shaking with intensity. How had he gotten past the guard? If he'd hurt Santa, I was going to be one pissed zombie mama. He spread his arms, hands open, palms toward me, the jerky shaking evident despite the gloom.
"Come with me," he said.
Hoarse roughness in place of the ugly rasp of before. "Get away from my dad," I repeated. To my surprise, he obliged by taking a step back toward the wall, keeping his hands in clear sight.
"Please, come with me."
I heard the blend of intensity and desperation in his voice. He was dangerous and so not fooling around, but the please drew me. Shit. If he was about to do some nasty crap to me, I didn't want it to happen in here where someone else could get hurt or kids might see. "Outside." To my relief, he gave a single nod.
"This way,"
he replied, barely audible, tilting his head toward the door at the far end of the gym, opposite the main entrance. My relief ratcheted up a smidge as he led me through the door and down a short flight of stairs to an exit. If he'd come in this way, hopefully it meant Santa was all right. My pulse slammed as I followed him, and I breathed a silent prayer of thanks that I drank the bottle of brains only a few hours earlier. I was far from fully tanked, but at least I wasn't hungry. He exited the building, then moved behind the hedge along the back wall and crouched, fisting his hands on his knees. I stayed far enough back that he couldn't reach out and grab me. "What do you want?" A shudder racked him.
"What did you see?"
"Yeah, right," I said with a snort.
"Why should I tell you anything so you know whether or not to kill me?"
I smiled sweetly and spread my hands. "I didn't see anything at all. How's that?" Even in the low light, I could see the grimace that twisted his features.
"You shouldn't tell me."
He shook his head as though trying to clear confusion, then pulled two small glass vials from his pocket, one half full of a milky yellow liquid, the other full of a milky blue one. His hands trembled as he uncapped the half-full vial and downed the contents. "What the hell is that?" I asked, scowling. "What's going on?"
"Stabilizer."
He held up a heavy, tremoring hand.
"For this."
I consciously resisted the urge to move to him, clasp his hand between mine to soothe him. Pursing my lips, I regarded him for a long, silent moment. "Dr. Cherish did that to you?" I finally asked. Giving a single nod, he leaned his head back against the wall and closed his eyes. I took a very cautious step forward. "Do you need brains?" I asked quietly. He didn't open his eyes.
"Yes,"
he said, in a cracked whisper, tinged with a desperation I didn't think he intended to reveal. "Stay here," I told him. "I'll be right back." I didn't wait for a response. Simply hurried back inside to the little fridge and my last bottle. Holy crap, but I really hoped I wasn't making a god-awful mistake. Every fiber of logic in me said to let him rot, literally. He'd been a complete ass to me since I'd turned him, and it was crazy to believe that as soon as I gave him the brains he wanted, he wouldn't do something ugly. I grabbed the bottle and headed out again. Philip had shifted to sit with his back against the wall, his head lowered. In that moment, looking like anything but a badass zombie soldier. I unscrewed the bottle top and crouched by him. "Here, drink this," I said. He lifted his head, pain flickering over his face as if the simple movement cost him tremendous effort.
"I shouldn't be here,"
he croaked, making no move to take the bottle. Scowling, I plopped my ass down beside him. "You're here now. Drink." After another few seconds of hesitation, he finally took the bottle from me and slugged down half the contents. A wave of confusion passed over his face as he lowered the bottle.
I had plenty of my own confusion going. My zombie baby had been a complete and utter asshole,